Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a minute, a 4th of July celebration of a great chapter in the American songbook. But first, some states are still struggling to pass new budgets in this first week of the new fiscal year. Until they do, summer school has been cut in Florida, California has started to send out IOUs, and as many as 69,000 state workers face the prospect of getting partial or no paychecks in Pennsylvania. Let's check in there. Jan Murphy is the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Patriot News in Harrisburg. Jan, is this just a bluff in the budget standoff between Governor Ed Rendell and the state legislature?
No, I definitely don't think it's a bluff. The governor is very committed to the level of spending that he wants to do, and the Senate Republicans are adamant that Pennsylvania must live within its means this year and cannot afford the broad-based tax increase that the governor needs to support his spending plan.
This is the Democratic governor, Ed Rendell, who wants to raise income taxes, and the Republicans in the legislature do not want to do that. Well, we understand some court employees might be affected as soon as today.
That's correct. They received a check today that only gave them money for the time worked through June 30th. Anything in the new fiscal year, they will have to wait until a budget is passed.
What about prison guards, correction officers, you know, police?
They, too, will face the prospect of payless paydays. There is a rift in Pennsylvania, though, because the governor has decided the inmates will continue to get paid for the work that they do. I mean, granted, it's like 35 cents an hour, but it's paid out of revenue that is from their canteen fund, but it's not the general fund. And it's the general fund. Anybody who is paid for out of the general fund are the ones who will face the payless paydays. And that includes the governor, the legislators, although the legislative staff will continue to be paid, and that is another source of contention because the legislature socks away, it's about over $200 million that they have in a reserve fund for times like these.
Well, and Governor Rendell announced this week that 10 banks and credit unions have agreed to extend low and no interest loans to the state employees who are going to be affected. And once a budget is passed, they'll be paid retroactively. But they still would have to go through the trouble of taking out a loan. And, of course, for loans, you need to be eligible and creditworthy. So some of them presumably might not get loans. I mean, are there going to be state workers literally not having income?
Absolutely. And that is a very serious concern. Even the governor and legislators realize that we have many state workers who live paycheck to paycheck. And I've been contacted by many that are seriously worried about what they're going to do to keep food on the table and shelter over their heads, because they're saying, you know, we still have to pay for gas to get to work because we're required to come to work. Where are we going to get that money? The gas station doesn't let me say, oh, I'll come back and pay for my gas once my paycheck starts coming again.
Well, and who do people blame? Most states are in this situation because of the economy, because taxes have plummeted. The revenue is just not coming into the states. But Pennsylvania has been in a tough spot before. I think you were telling me this is, what, the seventh or eighth year in a row that you've had to work on the fourth weekend because the budget never passes. So who are people blaming?
I think that many Pennsylvanians do not want to see taxes increase. And so in that regard, they're supporting the Republicans. But those who operate social services know what the cuts that would be required if there is not a tax increase. They see how different Pennsylvania will be without enough money to support the food banks, and, you know, at a time when so many people are jobless outside of government. So they just see that Pennsylvania would definitely change without the level of spending that the governor wants.
Jan Murphy, Capitol Bureau Chief of the Patriot News in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where state workers face going without any pay until a budget is passed there. Jan, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's a Friday, it's a holiday that celebrates the birth of the country, and it's a perfect opportunity to play a few pages from the National Songbook. What do these songs have in common?
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, you're crying all the time.
La la la, la la la, la 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 la. There's a rose in black and Spanish Harlem.
got the papers and the trash.
All of these songs, plus Kansas City, On Broadway, Only in America, and much more, were written by the songwriting team of Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, two self-described white Jewish kids from the East Coast who wanted to write songs for black artists, and they did, enough to fill a jukebox. Jerry Lieber grew up in Baltimore, lugging sacks of potatoes and coal from his mom's grocery store to the city's black neighborhoods, where he fell in love with the blues. Mike Stoller's mom dated George Gershwin. He grew up in New York City and discovered jazz at a leftist summer camp. But they met as teens in 1950 on the West Coast. Jerry was looking for someone to write music for his lyrics. A friend recommended Mike. It was the start of what they called an argument without resolution that's lasted for more than 50 years. It fills their new book, Hound Dog, the Lieber and Stoller Autobiography. And they join us from the studios of NPR West for a trip through their jukebox. Jerry Lieber, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
And Mike Stoller, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be here.
You guys still fighting and arguing?
Of course.
Of course. Couldn't have it any other way.
Remind us, how old were you? It's astonishing to see the
17.
Hits that come out. You were 17 when you met?
Yes.
And what did you think of yourselves? Because as you read the book, you seemed at that point already maybe 30-something, so wise in the ways of music. How did you view yourselves?
We thought we were black. The only disappointment was when we passed a mirror and we were disillusioned. And we admired those singers like Jimmy Witherspoon and Charles Brown. And, of course, when we met Big Mama Thornton, we were indeed inspired by her.
Well, let's start with Charles Brown. You had your first success with a song called Hard Times. There's a picture of the 45 in the book on Aladdin Records and the singer Charles Brown. Let's listen.
I've got pains in my head, dead on my feet. My pantry's empty. I ain't eaten for a week. Hard times.
Well, so there you are, off and running. Your next hit, Kansas City. Now, this is one that you argued about. What was the argument?
I wanted to do a standard phrase just so that the song would emerge as a no-nonsense blues.
And I wanted to write something that if it was played instrumentally, that people would recognize it as the song that we wrote.
On to Kansas City.
And Jerry Lieber, you write in your book, you hate admitting that you were wrong about Kansas City, but Mike was right on the money.
I could have been right as well, but Mike was the winner of the conversation, and he wrote a great melody. It's still out there today.
Yeah.
And I'm so pleased that he won.
Me too.
Well, right around the corner is Hound Dog, and you mentioned Big Mama Thornton. Tell us a little bit about this, because this was a very big woman, as her name would imply. And yet, when you first met with her with Hound Dog, the song you'd written, Jerry, you tried to suggest to her how it should be sung. That didn't go over well, but she wasn't getting it at first, was she?
She didn't really know what the song was about. She was crooning the song as if she were Crosby. The song was not about crooning a love song. It was about a woman throwing a gigolo out of her house. And when I tried to tell her what was going right and what was going wrong, she said, "Listen to me, white boy. Don't be telling me how to sing the blues." And I backed up because I wasn't going to get caught in that argument.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around the door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around the door. You can wear
she did finally get it. She heard the, as you say, the rough and tough of the song, the implicit sexual humor. And so you have this hit with her in this. We can't believe how many different side stories there are in your two stories. And one of them involves the Andrea Doria, which is the ship that sank off the East Coast. Mike Stoller, you are on that ship. You survive the sinking. You come to shore.
When I came down the gangplank, there was Jerry, and he ran up. He threw his arms around me. He said, "Mike, you're okay." And I said, "Yeah, I guess I am." He said, "Mike, we got a smash hit." I said, "You're kidding." He said, "No, Hound Dog." I said, "Big Mama Thornton?" He said, "No, some white kid named Elvis Presley."
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl. You're crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl. Crying all the time. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit and you ain't no friend of mine.
So Elvis has a huge hit with your song, but Jerry, you originally weren't very happy with that, because in his version, your lyrics are changed.
Which meant that the entire meaning of the song was obliterated. It was written to be a story about a young lady who gets rid of this guy who's sponging off of her, living off of her. Quit snooping around my door, you ain't nothing but a hound dog. Quit snooping around my door, you can wag your tail, but I ain't gonna feed you no more.
Those real lines.
Changed.
Yeah.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Crying all the time. You ain't never caught a rabbit and you ain't no friend of mine, which has nothing to do with the original idea of the song. I thought it was just going to ruin it, and it didn't. He sold more millions of records with that song than we ever did in our whole entire careers.
I think that the line, "You ain't nothing but a hound dog," is the most important factor in both of those records, because there's a kind of explosive anger in it. And I think that's what really makes that song a hit.
Well, and of course, it wasn't your only hit with Elvis. Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller wrote this and two other songs for the movie Jailhouse Rock when they were just 23. Elvis called them his good luck charms, but his manager, Colonel Parker, stepped in and stopped the friendship. We are talking with the great songwriters, Jerry Lieber, Mike Stoller. Their new book is Hound Dog, the Lieber and Stoller autobiography. It tells of mentoring Phil Spector, influencing Burt Bacharach. They had a business partner who gambled away their record label to the mob once. We're going to hear much more about their story. Later today, the document that sounded the call for freedom long before the Declaration of Independence. That's still to come. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Fee-fee-fi-fi-fo-fo-fum. I smell smoke in the auditorium. Charlie Brown, he's a clown. That Charlie Brown, he's gonna get caught. Just you wait and see.
Why is everybody always picking on me?
Welcome back to our conversation with the great American songwriting team of Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. Their new book is Hound Dog, the Lieber and Stoller autobiography, telling of hits like Charlie Brown that seemed to just come out of thin air. Mike would be fooling around on the piano, Jerry puttering in the kitchen, shouting out whatever popped into his head, including one time, "Take out the papers and the trash," which instantly became the hit Yakety Yak. But Mike, wasn't there also one time, and only one time, when the lyrics and music that you guys worked on separately came together perfectly?
Oh, yeah.
Now, is that all there is?
That's
the refrain.
That's the song that that eventually Peggy Lee sang for you. But it wasn't all that easy. I mean, that refrain came together easily for you, but that working with her didn't come together that easily.
Well, she loved the song. Jerry had presented the song to her, and if I remember correctly from what Jerry told me at the time, she said to him, "This is the story of my life, and you'd better not give it to anybody else because this is my song."
Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all there is.
Well, interestingly, you had shopped it around before it came to Peggy Lee, and Marlene Dietrich turned it down because she said it was the song of her life. What did she say? "This is who I am, not what I do. I don't want to sing it."
That's it. That's exactly what she said. She said, "This is who I am. This song is who I am, not what I do."
Well, another moment. With Benny King, you wrote Stand By Me, and then Only in America, and it was considered too political at the time. This was... Martin Luther King had just been thrown in jail in Birmingham for staging a protest. So you were convinced to pull the Drifters off the song Only in America and put Jay and the Americans on. There was racial strife, and yet here you were steeped in black music.
Actually, we felt at that time that the very patriotic type of lyric was satire.
When the Drifters sang it was satire.
Especially,
right?
Yes, and we thought that everybody would get it. Jerry Wexler, Atlantic Records, said, "Man, they're going to come up and string us up if we put this out." So the group Jay and the Americans, who we were producing, wanted to do the song. They loved the sound of it. They loved the track. So they did it, and of course it... became a kind of a hit. In fact, it was a hit, but it was very patriotic.
Only in America can a guy from anywhere go to sleep a pauper and wake up a millionaire.
Recently, a number of people, including myself, tried to get a re-release of the Drifters doing it because... in this day and age, when we have an African-American president of the United States, those lines in the song really have a totally different meaning than what was intended back, when that was recorded.
Only in America can a guy from anywhere go to sleep a pauper and wake up a millionaire. A kid without a cent get a break and maybe grow up to be president.
It's no longer satire to say only in America. What are the lines? Only in America can a man with...
can a kid without a cent get a break and maybe grow up to be president.
Right. Yeah. Boy, there is just so much in this. We haven't even gotten to the barroom brawl in Elaine's with author Norman Mailer. There's so much. I guess Jerry Lieber, Mike Stoller, is there still music? Is there still...
Oh, yes, there's music. We're writing it. Mike just finished a score to an original musical that's going to go on in Pasadena very soon. I'm working on a second project that I'm trying to get in shape.
Can you tell us what that is?
Yes, it's a life story of Oscar Wilde as a musical.
And is there any pop music you guys are hearing today that you think will be humming 50 years from now?
50?
Yeah.
Just the songs we're writing now.
Again, yes, we don't believe... we always thought that our songs were good for a weekend and that they wouldn't last. And when they started lasting, we changed our minds about our material and we thought, you know what? It did get to be standard material,
right,
which is what we were actually looking for, and that's what we all wanted to do. All the young writers wanted to write or have the reputation for writing standards.
Yeah, you say at the top were guys like Gershwin and Irving Berlin, and by the way, you listened to classical music as well, and at the bottom were guys like you, but I think you did pretty good swimming up to the top there.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It was a good swim.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Jerry Lieber, Mike Stoller, their book is Hound Dog, the Lieber and Stoller Autobiography, but as we've just heard, it's not finished yet. Gentlemen, thank you both.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you very much.
Hear a little of George Benson's cover of Lieber and Stoller's On Broadway. Still ahead today, a book for the 4th of July about colonial America on the brink of revolution, featuring a political murder mystery and a very sexy romance. After the latest news, here and now. Where's the best place to watch fireworks this 4th of July weekend? Well, according to Travel and Leisure magazine, the Eastern Seaboard, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and New York, up to where we are in Boston, although the rain could make it tough to see. But also in the top 10, Addison, Texas, just north of Dallas. This town of 15,000 draws crowds of up to 200,000. Their fireworks display can be seen by 500,000 people. That's why they call Addison Kaboom Town. Lee Dunn is deputy city manager. So, Lee, we have the Boston Pops playing the 1812 Overture live to cannons from the Old North Church and fireworks on a barge. What do you have?
Well, I would say that is impressive, but to top that, we start our fireworks display with the flyover by the Kavanaugh Flight Museum, which has one of the best collections in the world because all of his planes are flyable. And we will have a whole series of flights starting with the T-28 Trojan, Sky Raider, Wildcat, and then we'll have a Stearman, and then we will have people doing airwalks and acrobats. So that sort of kicks off our fireworks show.
Okay. All right. Well, that's pretty good. And then you have a 30-minute fireworks show. We understand choreographed music and a live radio simulcast.
That's true.
How long have you been doing this?
Well, we've been doing it close to 24 years. Addison was at one time a very rural community that grew very quickly. And as a result, there was a lack of traditions. And so many years ago, the city fathers felt it was important to begin to develop activities and opportunities for community and traditions. And Kaboom Town was one of them.
Well, now how many fireworks shells, you know, how many do you fire off?
We fire off 2,000 shells in a 30-minute span, and 25% of those shells are for the finale. So it gives you a sense of how awesome and how spectacular that is.
Well, and how do you afford this? Because we know several towns this year have canceled their firework displays because of the recession. That includes two right near you, Garland and Carrolltown.
That's true.
So how do you afford it?
We have 22 hotels, 170 restaurants, and over 11 million square feet of office space. So we're very urban. We are very fortunate because we get money from the hotel tax, and it is the hotel tax that we use for part of the Kaboom Town production. And certainly, Kaboom does promote tourism. People come and stay in our hotels. They make it a weekend. Our restaurants do phenomenal, phenomenal business.
We, in fact, understand that their sales increase from 25 to 200%. You might spend $250,000 on the fireworks, but in return, you can make $2.5 million on just the tourists that come in?
That's true. The whole production, guts, feathers, and all for Kaboom is $250,000. The actual fireworks themselves is only $40,000. We've done an economic impact, and the return to the community, the hotels and the restaurants, is about $2.5 million.
Well, here in the Northeast, we are having the soggiest summer that many of us can remember, and we're concerned that we'll be looking up and not see a thing because it'll disappear in the clouds. But you have an opposite problem. You've had drought down there.
Right. We've only had one year when the fireworks weren't able to launch because of rain, and we actually did a repeat after that. But as you said, we've had the drought. As part of our preparations, we have fire department on standby. We actually prepare the area where the fireworks are launched, and they're all launched by computer. And so we have a plan in place so that everybody can enjoy, and there are no issues as a result of it.
So that Addison doesn't really become Kaboom Town.
Exactly.
That's Lee Dunn, Deputy City Manager of Addison, Texas, also known as Kaboom Town because of its annual 4th of July fireworks display.
which actually, Robin, we do tonight.
So happy 3rd of July to you, Lee.
Same to you, Robin. Enjoy, and I hope you get to celebrate your fireworks as well.
Okay, thank you. And for the thousands here in Boston who do flock to the Esplanade to try to see the fireworks and the Boston Pops, and millions more watching on national television, there is a chance of showers late tomorrow afternoon. What a shock. We've turned into Seattle. So fingers crossed. Back in 30 seconds, here and now. Just in time for the 4th of July, British researchers announced that a rare copy of the Declaration of Independence has been found in that country's national archives. It's one of 200 copies printed on July 4th, 1776, by Philadelphia printer Joseph Dunlap for military and political leaders, including George Washington. Fewer than 30 of the Dunlap broadside, as collectively they've come to be known, still exist today. And the British archives can now claim to own three of them, so at least they got something out of being on the losing side of the revolution. The last Dunlap print sold for over $8 million in 2000, but a spokeswoman for the British Archives says this newest discovery is not for sale. It's a lovely document, isn't it? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. But there was another call to freedom that came more than 100 years earlier.
Our desire is not to offend one of our Savior's little ones in whatsoever form, name, or title he appears in, whether Presbyterian, Independent, Baptist, or Quaker, but shall be glad to see anything of God in any of them, desiring to do unto all men as we desire all men should do unto us, which is the true law both of church and state.
In 1657, 30 farmers in the tiny town of Flushing, New York, signed the Flushing Remonstrance, criticizing New Amsterdam Governor Peter Stuyvesant, he of the peg leg and quick temper, for his harsh treatment of Quakers. Now, New Amsterdam, what is now New York City, was a Dutch settlement and one of the most diverse communities in the world because, with the exception of Governor Stuyvesant, the Dutch were very tolerant. Also, unlike the Puritans here in Boston, who sent Quakers into exile because of the Quaker belief that God's grace comes to every person directly and not through a religious hierarchy. Kenneth T. Jackson is a professor of history at Columbia University in New York. Professor, why else were these two cities different?
New Amsterdam was a little bit different from Boston in the sense that while Boston was created as a Puritan commonwealth, as a city on a hill, New York, or then called New Amsterdam, was created by the Dutch to make money. And because it was not about religion from the beginning, there was always a tendency in New Amsterdam to be more open than in other colonies because they didn't care. They just wanted to trade. But some groups were considered a little beyond the pale. Quakers, whom we think now of as fairly pleasant, unobtrusive people who mostly oppose war and don't cause trouble, in the 17th century, they were seen as rabble-rousers, as people who made trouble. And so to tolerate Quakers was really to go pretty far.
Well, you mentioned Boston, and we do think of it as a place of tolerance today. But in this time, in the 1600s, Boston's governor threatened Quakers with the death penalty. Bostonians thought that was too harsh, so instead they passed a law saying Quakers had to be dragged half-naked through town while being whipped, and then they were branded with a letter. It is hard to wrap our brains around. What was it about Quakers that was so infuriating governors in both Massachusetts and in New Amsterdam?
They made a lot of racket. They demonstrated. They were sort of the radicals of the time.
Huh.
And Governor Stuyvesant said that he would arrest and fine anyone who would tolerate their presence, who would harbor Quakers. This was a harsh ordinance. The residents of the region felt that religious freedom was part of the tradition. And the fact that the governor general was going against their tradition was something they thought they should protest.
Well, they were so upset in what is now Flushing, Queens, that a town clerk got together with some people in Flushing and wrote, well, a rebuke to Governor Stuyvesant. It became known as the Flushing Remonstrance. What did they write?
Well, it's really a beautiful, beautiful document that deserves to be much better known in American history because it really is in some ways maybe the earliest and best articulation of the principle of religious freedom in our country. I think it starts off, "We desire, therefore, in this case, not to judge, lest we be judged, neither to condemn, lest we be condemned, but rather let every man stand and fall to his own master." And so I think they put together this elegantly written document, which I think is important for several reasons.
Well, let's tick through them. They borrowed from their town charter, which had been written in 1645 in Flushing. Tell us more about why it is so remarkable.
Well, I would say first it articulated a fundamental right, which not only is basic to our conception of ourselves now in the 21st century, but they felt was basic to their conception of themselves in this remote outlying town of what's now the borough of Queens in New York City. So first, it articulates a right. Secondly, they didn't just whisper and say, "Oh, it's a bad thing." They literally signed the document, sent it to the most powerful official in the colony. And that official, Peter Stuyvesant, as we know him today, was not known for toleration or graciousness or anything else. Thirdly, they stood up for others. None of the 30 signers of the Flushing Remonstrance was himself a Quaker. They were articulating a principle which was not immediately beneficial to them.
Well, and at great risk. Stuyvesant immediately arrested the people who brought the document to him. He jailed some who had signed it.
Exactly.
And then it went even further. He arrested someone who did bring Quakers, I believe, to his home.
Indeed, John Bound, for whom Bound Street in Flushing is now named. When Bound was arrested, he took passage to Amsterdam and put his case before the Dutch and themselves. And in 1663, the Dutch West India Company officially overruled Governor Stuyvesant and ordered that religious toleration be the law of the colonies. The Dutch are saying it must be enforced in New York. We don't care whether you, Peter Stuyvesant, agree with them or not, accept anything about them. Leave them alone.
Well, and even though they said that they felt Quakerism was an abominable religion.
Right, right. That's what's so important about it. I think religious freedom is only really tested when it's somebody whose beliefs are very different from your own. I mean, it's only when somebody is doing something that, or believes something that is abominable, that you really find out what your commitment to freedom is. And I think on the 4th of July, when we celebrate independence in the United States and our freedoms, you know, we somehow and often, I think, do it a little too glibly. We have to remember that it's the underclass, it's the despised, whose rights we have to respect. And if we only respect the rights of people who are more or less just like us, then really our rights don't amount to very much. And here in 1657, they're standing up for somebody else and saying, we need to believe in this principle, even though it doesn't affect us.
That's Professor Kenneth Jackson from Columbia University, also a scholar on things early New York City, talking about the Flushing Remonstrance, written in 1657, remonstrating the then governor of New York about religious freedom. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Okay, quick look ahead. Monday on Here and Now, some states have started special criminal courts for the mentally ill who commit crimes. Do they work? And a young woman shrinks her carbon footprint by living in a house the size of a closet. That's Monday. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now. It is the day before the 4th, so why not consider a book full of fireworks? The New York Times called Blind Spot an erudite and entertaining recreation of colonial America on the brink of the revolution. Not bad for a first crack at fiction by old friends and historians Jane Kamensky and Jill Lepore. The book is part history, part fiction. It features a political murder mystery and a very sexy romance. The full title is Blind Spot by a Lady in Disguise and a Gentleman in Exile. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock first met up with the co-authors earlier this year on Boston's Long Wharf.
This is where Blind Spot begins and ends, so it seemed like a natural place to meet these history professors turned novelists for a conversation and a tour of some of the prominent scenes in the book. Jane Kamensky teaches at Brandeis, Jill Lepore at Harvard. They started this as a serious project, a small gift for a mentor.
but they had so much fun it grew into a big novel, 500 pages in all, in the tradition of Tom Jones. They took turns writing chapters, which take the form of letters written by the main characters. Kaminsky's are from The Lady in Disguise, addressed to her best friend. Lepore's from The Gentleman in Exile, addressed to the reader. That gentleman is a portrait painter named Stuart Jameson, Jamie to his friends. He arrives in Boston horribly seasick, along with his slobbering dog Gulliver, in 1764, having fled creditors in his native Scotland.
And when Jameson arrived here and looked out at the city, he would have seen a city that looked like a town by any kind of Scottish standards, by Edinburgh standards, a town moving up on a hill. But what we can see here, if you're standing looking directly into the city, the structure that would have jumped out from Jameson's point of view and jumps out to everybody even as they're nearing shore is what we call the old state house, was called the townhouse in the 18th century before the revolution. It was built in 1713 and was one of the larger and more dominant structures in the city. And you can see how dwarfed it is here by every other building, these skyscrapers of the kind of downtown financial district.
He had obviously been in big towns. He'd been in London. Was he impressed by what he saw here? What did he think of what he saw here?
What he thinks about Boston is much based on, again, what contemporary travelers from Europe thought about Boston when they visited around this period, was that it had a kind of oversized ambition. You know, the town, you know, it is Winthrop City on a hill, founded in 1630. It has this lofty and quite pious set of ambitions about being a model for all the world, to see a beacon unto the world. And it's kind of a backwater. And it's also, in the 1760s, devastated financially. So shops were closed everywhere. I mean, the city was deep in a terrible recession as in the consequence of the French and Indian War.
Did you have something to add to that, Jane?
He's not overly awed by London. So he, as we fill in his backstory, you learn that he has begun to climb the rungs of the painter's ladder in 18th century London, and he leaves. He doesn't like the sort of social climbing, glittery atmosphere of the metropolis. So one of the things that happens to him in the course of the story is he becomes more contented in a backwater, what would have been a backwater to him with his cosmopolitan background, than his counterpart, Fanny Easton, who is born to Boston and can only look out. You know, he's sort of looking in and winds up being quite charmed by what he sees facing west. And she's all about facing east with longing and wondering what it would be like to get out of this place that's 2 miles long and less than a mile wide.
That's Jane Kaminsky, dropping a hint, perhaps, of how Blind Spot ends. Her Fanny Easton is a talented painter in her own right, determined to turn her talent into liberty. But she's cast into disgrace after being seduced by her painting master in the home of her prominent father.
And she bore a child, and rather than do what her father wanted her to do, which was become a governess or marry the seducer, she fled and winds up, after a stint working in the manufactory house with other impoverished Bostonians, passing herself off as a boy to gain a spot as Jameson's apprentice. So that's how they meet, is she presents her sketches to him, sketches she's made in rough charcoal on the bits of paper that she can purloin in the manufactory house.
Of those sketches, Jameson raves. He writes, "Sweet Jesus, surpassing work. Astonished reader, who could have thought, in this town on the edge of the world, to find such raw genius?" Jamie clearly sees Fanny's talent, but he can't see through her disguise. Fanny is so busy trying to maintain that disguise, she can't see Jamie falling in love with her. The authors were in the same boat, because they were writing about their characters independently. They weren't even sure Fanny and Jamie would overcome those blind spots. So as part of the finding out process, Lepore and Kaminsky spent time in a home from the era. It's called the Pierce Hitchborn House. It's one of the earliest brick structures in Boston.
Blind Spot is a love story, and I think at the time we came here, we were very much in the what's going to happen next part of the love story. So I think, you know, the smallness of the house at that particular moment in the storytelling, where, as you know, we were mentioning before, we had no idea what was going to happen. Were they really going to get together? Were they not? And so there was this kind of a different kind of edge to that.
I mean, a house of this scale, it's like being marooned on a ship. I mean, it's a small space, especially the passageways. Like the, you know, they didn't design their houses for flow. They designed their houses to hold heat in a fuel-scarce environment.
In time, as you might have guessed, Fanny and Jamie generate their own heat. But they also get involved in solving an elaborate political murder mystery involving Boston slaves and Fanny's father. But in the end, this is a romance, and it builds to a final scene inside the tiny room high atop the old state house.
You caught your breath? Okay. So isn't this the most beautiful place in all of Boston?
I can't imagine what it would be like without all the buildings.
You'd be looking at crow's nests and steeples from up here, and... But there was nothing of economic significance in the city that you couldn't see from this spot.
What happens in the novel in this tiny little room is something that where you could see everything but be unseen. And that's what I find so magical about being up here. And we really can, from this very tiny place, picture the whole of the city. And we talked about when we started the tour how the journey of the novel for Jameson's character is about feeling that he's kind of been washed ashore in this backwater, this kind of prim, provincial, and pious place. And over the course of the novel, he falls in love with Boston and falls in love with what it is to be in the rebellious provinces, looking back toward England and imagining a different kind of politics and imagining a world without arbitrary rule. And that's part of the passion that the novel is about, that's supposed to be part of what's captured in this room.
And Fanny and Stuart see that future from here.
Although they see it looking in somewhat different directions. So she still has this powerful yearning for what she can only imagine from across the sea. It's his special location, having come from the metropolitan center, to prize the bumptious provincialism of this place in a way that still at the end of the novel feels confining and not redemptive to her.
So at this point, you might be asking, do Fanny and Jamie end up together, happily ever after, as the colonies hurtle toward the American Revolution? All I can say, dear listener, is this. A painter must paint. Thank you.